We're talking with Wayne Buscelli, a lifelong animal welfare advocate who's on the front lines of numerous battles. You know, it takes time to change public attitudes and perceptions as well as policies, but it can happen. It is happening. It's happened on corporate views of animal welfare issues on multiple levels, and there are more battles being fought now, and public involvement can really make a difference. We're going to get into some specifics on how you can help in just a moment here on Coast to Coast. Wayne Buscelli, before the break, you were describing this omnibus farm bill that where the USDA is involved in so many animal welfare issues. Factory farming is a topic you and I have discussed on this program. It's an area where you and various animal welfare groups have made great progress in recent years, right?
It is. Factory farming, you know, really refers to kind of the intensive confinement of animals raised for food. And oftentimes with chickens, whether they're laying hens or broiler birds or pigs, they're kept in these warehouses and jammed into these facilities, you know, so tightly they can barely move. And the worst cases have been gestation crates for pigs, which are 2-foot by 7-foot cages that house the breeding sows, who may weigh 300 or 400 or even 500 pounds. So for the 3 or so years that they're alive, they're effectively immobilized. They can't even turn around. They bite the bars of the cage. They swing their heads back and forth, you know, as a kind of symbol of their psychology and the real troubles that they're having in this terrible environment. Or for chickens, laying hens specifically, they're kept in what are called battery cages. They're small wire cages about the size of a bread box, and 6 or 8 birds are jammed into the cage. They're wing to wing. They can't extend their wings, and that's their life. They never get out of that cage for the 12 to 18 months that they're alive. Then when they're no longer producing many eggs, then they're sent off to a plant to be slaughtered to make, you know, chicken pot pie or chicken soup, some low-grade chicken product. That is just a real deviation of what farming has been about. You know, when we think of farming, we think of animals in pastures. We think of them moving around. And, yes, they're used for the products. They're going to be killed, whether it's eggs, milk, or meat. But at least they had a life that was worth living. But on the factory farm, you know, the slaughter is unfortunately the most merciful end to this, because they are not allowed to move in any meaningful way. That's starting to change. And George, I sent you a press release from McDonald's, which made a commitment a few years ago that I was involved with in a meaningful way to end their purchase of eggs from cage hen facilities. And McDonald's on its website issued a report saying that they're about a third of the way there. They're going to try to meet this deadline to buy 2.2 billion eggs a year from cage-free facilities. So now they're getting about 725 million of those eggs from cage-free operations, and it'll be 100% by 2025. Now, that's a long time, but this is a lot of infrastructure that's been built in the factory farming industry over the last 50 or 60 years, and it's going to take a little time to unwind all of that.
Well, I remember the predictions that the sky would fall if the California legislation passed and all the egg producers would leave California, and this would be just terrible. It put them all out of business. That didn't happen, though, did it?
Well, George, you're a good historian, and it's important that people, you know, hear about the past declarations from some of these animal use industry folks and say, oh, there's no other way we can do it. In 2008, I helped lead a ballot initiative, Prop 2, to ban all extreme confinement of chickens and pigs and veal calves in California. And as you note, a lot of them said, oh, it's impossible to raise them otherwise, and the egg supply is going to dwindle, and food prices are going to shoot up. None of that has happened, and to the contrary, voters in California had an opportunity in November 2018, 10 years later, and again just a few months ago, to weigh in on this again after 10 years. 10 years after Prop 2, let's make an assessment. Do you want to strengthen the law, or do you want to keep it the way it is, or, you know, maybe weaken it? And overwhelmingly, voters in California decided to strengthen the law. So now, in California in 2019, you won't be allowed, if you're a food seller, to sell, by the end of this year, to sell eggs from cage operations. And the same is going to hold true by 2021 for pork, that you can't sell pork, whether you're at a hotel or you're a restaurateur or you're a supermarket. You're not going to be able to sell pork if it comes from an operation that can find the pigs. That's what Californians said on the ballot, saying, hey, you know, we're eating animal products, but we insist that the animals be treated with some measure of decency and mercy. And I think this is a very hopeful sign that the American public, when given the opportunity, says yes to humane treatment of animals.
You know, there's a disconnect between food and how it's produced. You know, a lot of people just assume food comes from the grocery store. You pick it up in the meat department and don't think about how it's produced or the consequences for animals. So when you do get a chance to see that, it changes what you eat and what you would demand as a consumer. You know, a lot of the videos, undercover videos produced by animal welfare organizations that you've worked with and for have changed the world, have changed public perceptions. And yet there is a pushback. States passing these laws, these ag gag laws that try to outlaw videos of news coverage of cruel practices. It's hard to believe that that can exist in 21st century America.
Well, it's true, George, in the meat industry and the dairy industry and the egg industry have fought these reforms. Ag gag is just one of the latest issues where it forbids you from taking a picture of an animal on a factory farm because they know that those images are jarring to the American public. And rather than kind of state their case and allow that discourse to happen in society, they say, we're just going to forbid you from taking a picture. In other states, they've tried a right to farm constitutional amendment to basically forbid any future regulation of agriculture, that you can't regulate manure management or the overuse of antibiotics or impose humane treatment standards. Now, one of the big debates, George, is over cellular-based meat. You know, we're growing meat in labs now, and you know, it's the same. It's the cells of cows and pigs, and it's rather than in a fully formed organism, it's growing in a laboratory setting, and it's growing animal tissue, which is what you eat if you consume meat. Many of these states now, especially the big ag Midwestern states, are saying you can't label this as meat. The dairy industry is saying you can't label almond milk or soy milk as milk. They're trying to hijack the language and say that you can't call these things the familiar products that most of us as consumers, you know, grew up with. So there is an inevitable backlash, but I really feel like, you know, the public in this era of social media and investigative videos is getting a little bit more attuned to what's happening on factory farms, and when they see it, they don't like it.
Well, you know, you're going up against some powerful interests. When you talk about USDA being a focal point of legislative efforts, there's a cultural issue there. USDA folks come from agricultural backgrounds and are not always sympathetic to these causes.
No, a lot of people who observe government say that the agencies that are supposed to implement and execute our laws have become captured by the industries they regulate, and there's no better example of that historically than USDA. You know, it hasn't been so much a regulator of agriculture as a promoter of agriculture, and the idea that they're promoting the meat industry. You know, I wrote a thesis in college about the basic four food groups. When you and I were kids, George, you know, in the school lunchroom, you were told you've got to draw liberally from each of these four food groups. One was meat products, meat and fish, and then a second was eggs and dairy. Then it was grains, and then all the fruits and vegetables were jammed into one. That was not some kind of nutritional construction of the ideal diet. That was a political construction, and that's how we Americans consume more meat per capita than any people in the world. And you know, USDA has never been a neutral arbiter on these things, and they've been tough, and they're the ones, you know, in a broader sense, who enforce our animal welfare laws. That's why the puppy mills have proliferated, and the penalties are weak, and this terrible practice of horse soaring, where they injure the feet of these Tennessee walking horses. USDA's had a law to enforce that statute since 1970, and the industry just continues to you know, barbarically treat horses and injure their feet so that these trainers can win ribbons at horse shows in the Southeast.
I saw a video that you sent me of this horse soaring, the aftermath of what it means to the animals. I was going to post it on Coast to Coast, but I thought it might be, it really be disturbing to a lot of people to see it. They can see it on the website of Animal Wellness Action, I guess, but describe what the process is, why they do it, and how many horses are affected.
George, one of the things in my career and working on animal protection issues, you know, you find out these things you never heard of and then wonder, you know, how diabolical can people be to do this? And how can policymakers and regulators allow this conduct to continue? And it's called horse soaring. It's S-O-R-I-N-G, so literally soaring, the word soar. And in this world, it's a show horse world for a few breeds, mainly the Tennessee Walking Horse. And there are hundreds of these shows around the country. Many of them are centered in Tennessee and Kentucky, but they occur, you know, as far west as California. And the trainers in a subset of this industry, not everybody who has a Tennessee Walking Horse, of course, does this, and many Tennessee Walking Horse owners are working with us to fight this abuse, but they injure the feet of the horses intentionally. They either burn chemicals on their feet, and they pack it in plastic in order to really have the chemicals kind of cook into the flesh of the animals, or they mechanically injure the animals. In this case, it was called pressure shoeing, where they drive nails through the hoof into the sensitive tissue of the hoof, of the feet, you know, beyond the hoof. So it's not just putting a nail into the hoof, it's into the tissue. And this horse, where Animal Wellness Action sent out a press release on Friday, and obtained footage of this animal. This poor animal had nerve damage and was just shaking and unable to control himself in terms of his kind of physical reaction after he had been pressure shod. And they do this, so again, their feet are so tender and they hurt so much that when they step down on the ground, they lift their legs higher. So it's an exaggerated gait, and that wins ribbons at horse shows. And the judges are all part of this because they know that the only way you get that exaggerated gait is to injure the feet of the horses. And this is masquerading as sport in the horse show world, and it needs to end. There's a bill on this called the Prevent All Soaring Tactics Act, which would strengthen a 1970 statute called the Horse Protection Act, a federal law that forbids this. But the law is in desperate need of an upgrade, and that's why we're working with veterinarians in Congress, Kurt Schrader of Oregon, Ted Yoho of Florida, and then a couple of senators, Mark Warner and Mike Crapo, to ban this practice by strengthening the law.
On racehorses. So I can remember seeing racehorses from the time I was a kid going with the parents and seeing these magnificent animals race around the track. And you come to love horses and gosh, it's exciting, but you don't see what happens behind the scenes. Are you making progress in dealing with racehorses, and what would the public need to know about how those animals are treated?
Well, sadly, we haven't made too much progress on this. There is legislation that really offers the prospect of progress, but the horse racing industry needs to be part of the solution. George, some of your listeners may have heard about a rash of horse deaths at a storied park in Southern California. It's called Santa Anita Park. It's in eastern L.A. County, framed by the beautiful San Gabriel Mountains, and they have a number of major races there, and then they have regular racing that occurs, you know, many months of the year. And since the end of December, about 30 horses have died at this track, and it's thought that it's a combination of factors, but one of them is that horses are being drugged to enhance performance and also to get injured horses on the track. And in no other racing jurisdiction in the world do we allow same-day medicating of horses. I mean, this is, you know, like Lance Armstrong being, you know, giving himself enhancements in order to race better than competitors, or it's like a baseball pitcher being souped up or a slugger being souped up. We don't allow this in other sports, and why are we allowing these equine athletes, why are we allowing veterinarians to do this to horses? It puts them at risk of breakdown, and what's happening in horse racing is that we're breeding horses for speed. You know, they have these thin champagne glass legs, and these are 1,000-pound animals who are racing at 45 miles an hour. And if they have a little physical vulnerability, in their legs, you know, with an injury, or if their body is being pushed beyond its normal limits, they're going to break down and crash, with the jockey being put at risk, and jockeys die every year as well. This is just a corrupting of the sport of horse racing, and it needs to stop, and the Santa Anita spate of deaths has been a marker to the American public that something is amiss in American horse racing. So there's federal legislation on this, the Horse Racing Integrity Act, to end same-day doping of horses on American tracks, not just for thoroughbreds, but for other types of horse racing that occur in the U.S.
In a similar vein, greyhound racing. You and other animal welfare advocates have been pretty vocal about the abuses suffered by these dogs. I mean, the stories have been around for years, and finally, there's a light at the end of the tunnel, I think, right?
Yeah, 30 years ago, there were 60 greyhound racing tracks in the U.S., not nearly as big an industry then as horse racing, and wow, has it withered. I mean, the American public has basically sent a verdict by simply not patronizing these places. You go to greyhound tracks in the United States, and it's like there was an evacuation order, and everybody got it except the people running the dogs. I mean, the dogs are running around an oval, and there's nobody there. And what has happened, the biggest moment, is in November 2018, Florida voters saw a constitutional amendment on the ballot to phase out all greyhound racing there by the end of 2020. And Florida had 12 of the 18 remaining tracks in the U.S. So 30 years ago, 60 tracks. A few months ago, just 18 tracks in the U.S. Florida voters overwhelmingly voted to ban greyhound racing with nearly 70% of the vote. So those 12 tracks are all going to close by the end of 2020. Several have done that so already. So just 6 tracks will remain. And now it's just a question of how we negotiate the end of greyhound racing. It's a sport that really has lost its fan base. There are many on-track injuries for greyhound racing. There are problems with doping of the greyhounds, disposition of poor performing greyhounds. You know, what do they do with them? Just like with horse racing, some of the poor performing horses go, you know, to a truck and then are shipped to Mexico or Canada for slaughter. Some of the greyhounds don't face a great fate either. And we are really looking to see that this industry kind of phases out in relatively short order.
Just as Americans generally don't eat dogs, we also don't eat horses. But we do tend to ship horses out of the country. You know, we don't have slaughterhouses in the U.S. anymore where horse meat is carved up. But a lot of American horses are discarded. Wild horses that get through loopholes of the BLM, they get shipped abroad and get carved up for meat. Where do things stand on that?
Well, no one has done better and more reporting on this than you, George. So thank you for all of your incredible efforts through the years to expose problems with the Wild Horse and Burro program and horse slaughter and other issues. But as you say, America does not host horse slaughter plants anymore. The last 3 plants closed in 2007. There were 2 operating in the Dallas area and 1 outside of Chicago. And that ended. There have been many efforts since then to bring horse slaughter plants back, but we animal welfare advocates have been able to fend off those efforts. The most important legislative effort, though, now is to pass the SAFE Act, Save American Food Exports Act, and that would forbid shipping live horses to Mexico and Canada, because 100,000-plus horses are shipped to our North American neighbors every year where they operate slaughter plants over their borders. And, you know, these are, for the most part, healthy American horses. These are animals that are coming off of racetracks, or they're working animals. They are pleasure animals who got scooped up by a what's called a kill buyer. And then they just get loaded onto a truck, and they take a 12 or 20 or 30-hour drive to a slaughter plant in Canada or Mexico.
Wayne, I'm going to interrupt you for a second. We need to take another break. We'll continue our conversation about the wild horses and the SAFE Act and get some ideas on what you can do, then open up the phone lines when we come back. We've got examples that Wayne Pacelli has shared with us tonight about how public participation, your participation, can make a difference. It has made a difference in dramatic ways. Individual voices can change the situation in animal welfare issues. And, you know, you think basic decency isn't a radical proposal. I mean, it's not a partisan issue either. It should be sort of universal. And in a moment, when we come back, we open up the phone lines and we'll discuss some other ideas, specific things that you can do now to help animals around the world. We'll be right back. Wayne Pacelli, before the break, you were telling us about the SAFE Act. One of the things it would do would be to prevent the export of horses for meat. Where does that stand?
The House has a bill led by Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky to do this. It's got great bipartisan support. The Senate bill will be introduced by Robert Menendez and Lindsey Graham soon. Again, this is an issue. If the American public raises its voice, we will stop the slaughter of 100,000 American horses. If we stand on the sidelines, this problem will quietly persist. And I think that's the choice that we face.
If you had you could rattle off a list of legislative priorities for your organizations and others on animal welfare issues, what would be the top of the list off the top of your head? And then tell us how people can affect the outcome most directly.
Well, I really do want to urge folks who care about public policy on animal welfare to go to animalwellness.org and sign up for The Political Animal. It's a blog I write that updates people on what they can do on animal issues to advance the cause and also just gives a little analysis on what's going on. George, I'd say the PACT Act, the Prevent Animal Cruelty and Torture Act, that's a federal anti-cruelty statute. We don't have one in the United States. This creates it. It also bans bestiality. That's got a great chance of passing. I mentioned the PAST Act, the Prevent All Soaring Tactics. This stops the abusive practice of horse soaring of Tennessee walking horses. I think that's a great bill. The Shark Fin Trade Elimination Act to stop the trade in the fins of sharks who are being killed, as you noted earlier in our conversation, by the tens of millions. The SAFE Act to stop horse slaughter. The Horse Racing Integrity Act to stop doping of horses. There are other anti-wildlife trafficking bills. There are humane treatment of farm animals measures. There's a Humane Cosmetics Act to stop stop the use of animals for cosmetic testing, when hundreds of companies have already said, we don't need to do safety testing on animals. We have other more reliable alternative methods. So those are just a few, but you can go to animalwellness.org to get more information on all of this.
I want to mention one other issue before we open up the phone lines, and that deals with coyotes. They have these contests around the country, including in some towns here in Nevada. Go out and kill as many coyotes as you can, and the one who kills the most gets a prize. And I understand that, you know, here in urban areas that coyotes will, as we push further and further out into the desert, into the coyote's terrain, that they will snatch up a pet here and there, and people get pretty excited about it. But killing coyotes does not eliminate coyotes. They go into sort of a hyperdrive of reproduction, and you now have coyotes in places they never existed before.
George, you're absolutely right. I mean, not only do we have these despicable wildlife killing contests where people, again, are not engaging in, you know, what people would refer to as responsible hunting. They're not utilizing the carcass of the animals for food. They're just killing for killing's sake to amass a body count. And our federal government has been spending tens of millions of our tax dollars every year since the 1930s. And the federal government kills 100,000 coyotes a year, poisoning them, trapping them, shooting them, even from aircraft. And as you note, George, the range of coyotes has expanded dramatically. Now they're in all of the 48 continental states in the U.S. It wasn't the case before. And I think that these wildlife killing contests that happen often on our public lands in the West are one of the most disgraceful examples of our behavior toward wildlife. And fortunately, we're seeing some progress against it. I wrote about it, and a colleague wrote about it on our website, animalwellnessaction.org. But New Mexico has just banned these wildlife killing contests. Arizona has an Arizona Game and Fish Commission rulemaking action to stop mass killing of coyotes and other animals who are the victims of these killing contests. Oregon has a bill, and a number of other states do as well. So this is an abuse. Hunters are joining with us to stop this because they say this bears no resemblance to what they think of as hunting.
Good. First-time caller, Carl in Galveston. Hi, Carl. Good morning.
How you doing, George? You're my favorite, and I like your guest tonight. I miss the UFOs, but I like the animal rights information also. It's incredible. I'm a big bird lover. But anyway,
well,
the reason why I called, I was out fishing in the Gulf of Mexico, and I saw a mile and a half brown stain in the crystal blue water. It was horrible. It was behind a cruise ship. So I thought, man, that's weird. So I got home, did some research, and they're dumping billions of gallons of raw sewage out in the Gulf of Mexico, which can get the little fish mercury, and the big fish eat them, and then the humans eat those big fish. So I think there ought to be somebody investigating that, because there's millions of cruise ships around the world, and I heard they were dumping billions of gallons with a D. So that's all I had to say, and we'll get off the line.
Well, thanks, Carl. We'll see what Wayne has to say about that.
Well, Carl, thank you for your support, and thanks for drawing your attention to that issue. And, you know, if you're a fisherman, you know, you're dependent on having these animals live in a clean environment. And if they're getting heavy metals or if they're getting bacteria or other things that can harm us, that's a real self-interest concern. And, you know, a lot of the big cruise lines do dump this waste. They also have been a big contributor to exotic animal releases. The ballast contains many animals from all parts of the world, and they go halfway around the world and they introduce these species. So I think it's a big issue. And George, this is a lead in for me. I'm working with a new company called Carter Lou Capital. People can look at it by going to carterloucapital.com. This is the first investment advisor that it's building its investment strategies around animal welfare. And you've probably heard of socially responsible investment funds where people are concerned about fossil fuels and they're avoiding coal companies or something like that. There's never been an investment advisor focused on animal welfare. So now people like Carl and others, if they want to put their 401k money or if they want to put other capital to work in the markets, they can now have a tool that screens out companies that are doing the worst things for animals. So I'm really excited about this new Carnival Capital operation, and it goes straight to what Carl asked, which is companies need to be responsible actors. But who's watching them? If no one is building tools and strategies that are informed with this, with these details, then consumers are trapped and they have no options.
East of the Rockies, Ed in Beaumont. Hey, Ed, good morning. What's on your mind?
I've been a member of PETA for 32 years. 101st Airborne Ranger, been deployed in Grenada and Panama. Then when I got out of the military, I started hauling rodeo stock. And the atrocities that I've seen there, I had to quit. You know, it was unbearable. You know, he said nothing about rodeo.
Well, we'll get into it now. Thanks for the suggestion. Rodeo is a big business. It's a big business here in Las Vegas, Wayne.
It is. And, you know, it's one of those elements of our culture that's been around for a long time. And, you know, people, you know, who are involved in rodeo care passionately about it, but there's no question that the animals are often manhandled in rodeo. And, you know, calf roping, I think, has been identified as one of the most problematic practices where, you know, a calf runs out, you know, and get to 25 miles an hour, and then somebody lassoes it, and that rope is fixed to the horse, and the horse is a much larger animal than the calf, and the calf is just jerked, stop immediately. And, you know, the neck is a pretty vulnerable part of the body. So rodeo is an issue from an animal welfare perspective. And I think the caller's name was Ed. I hope I got that right. But thank you for your service to the country, Ed, in terms of your military work. And thanks for raising an issue. We should think about all these issues. Wherever you come down on them, whether you're a supporter or an opponent, we have a duty to think about how we're caring for animals in every setting in which we put them to work for us.
We're going to Derek in Denver on the wild card line. Good morning, Derek.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Hey, I was thinking about, you know, this factory farming stuff. But first of all, I'd like to say that my father was a world-class equestrian horse rider, you know, whatever, they jump over bushes and fences and stuff. And so he was totally in tune with horses, and but he never shared that with me, and so that was always been a sore spot with me, that he never even taught me how to ride a horse. But I think it's totally disgusting that we have cattle and chickens, and I mean, I love meat, I love eggs. I think it's totally disgusting that we just are like farming them at a factory level. It's like, how healthy can that be, you know?
Well, I mean, I'd have to, I think Wayne would probably have to agree with you. There have been substantial evidence and undercover investigations of the conditions that these animals are raised in. And you're right. How healthy can it be to eat pigs that live in the kind of conditions that we've seen in various videos? Wayne, you know more about it than I do.
Well, you know, a lot of human behavior is motivated by self-interest. And, you know, I think there's a great moral case to be made that we shouldn't be doing this to animals in the way that we are. I mean, factory farming is a disgrace when it comes to the treatment of animals. But as you say, George, and as the caller says, I mean, this rebounds to us. We give them antibiotics on these factory farms because they're so closely crowded together that they're going to get sick. And those antibiotics are the same classes that we use to treat human illness. And when they're overused, they're rendered useless. And there's a great medical crisis in this country with the overuse of antibiotics. These are a firewall against the big, big problems that we face in the human health circumstance. So I think on every level, factory farming really needs to be examined. And that means each one of us needs to think about our food choices. And eating more plant-based foods is better for us. It's better for the planet. It's better for animals.
First-time caller Jesse in San Antonio. Good morning, Jesse.
Good morning, sir. The only reason I called is because I wanted to give kudos to Mr. Wayne Boselli. I feel like there's a special place in heaven for him. I think what he's doing is wonderful, especially the work for the factory farming animals. And that's all I had to say.
Appreciate the call. We're going to go to Joe in Montana on the wild card line. Joe, welcome.
Good morning, George and Wayne. I live in Montana, and so I kind of have firsthand knowledge of some of these issues in regards to bears and such. I heard you mention grizzly bears. And currently, the state of grizzly bears in Montana and Wyoming and Idaho is that they are the top of the food chain predator. And so if anybody goes hiking in the woods, you know, you go to Yellowstone or something, that's something to bear in mind, is that as humans, we're not the top of the food chain right now because we're not allowed to hunt grizzlies, and they're not afraid of humans. And currently there's also a large population of grizzlies, larger, we keep finding out it's larger than we had previously assumed. And I think that hunting is what is the greatest tool that we have for conservation. I'm not saying we should eliminate any species, but it is the greatest tool that we have for conserving a species and making it safe for ourselves in the forest. So I'd just like to hear Wayne's take on that.
Thanks, Joe. Those are legitimate issues. Appreciate the call.
Yeah, Joe, thank you, and thanks for intelligently stating your view. I think I disagree in a general sense. You know, grizzly bears are still at risk, and they've been coming back a little bit in the Yellowstone area and then also in what's called the Northern Continental Divide ecosystem up in the Glacier National Park area. Still, humans have an impact. We're killing grizzly bears with our cars by roadkill. We're killing them in damage control cases where there's a bear that poses a threat. We kill them. There's also poaching. You know, if we were to allow of the 1,000 or so grizzly bears in the lower 48 states, allow 20 or so or 25 to be shot, that lesson is not going to be learned by the rest of those grizzlies any more than you know, when a grizzly is killed for damage control reasons or poaching, that informs the rest of the grizzlies. If they're alive, and because they are so powerful, because they are at the top of the food chain, as you noted, Joe, there are going to be conflicts that humans have with them. And yes, they can kill us. And we have always been very fearful of species that can kill us because, you know, we've been at the top of the food chain as human beings. But, you know, my argument is an argument for coexistence. I mean, this is a species that we just about wiped out. We reduced their range to just a fraction of what it is. And yes, they're in Montana. But a lot of Montanans love them and want to see them preserved and think that shooting them just for a trophy is not the way to go. If I'm not objecting when there's a threatening grizzly that animal be killed. It's regrettable. It's terrible. It's probably a consequence of our taking up so much space. But that should happen at times. But just to go out and kill an animal that's not bothering anybody for a trophy, I think that's a different category.
I appreciate the calls, all the calls. You know, in general, Wayne, at least, you know, in the macro scale, you look at the global situation and species extinction, it's scary, but progress is being made. You and the other animal welfare advocates and organizations are winning one battle at a time, it seems, at least on the domestic front.
Well, animal cruelty is part of our set of activities that we don't like. And as you said earlier, George, it's a universal value. The issue is how do we logically apply anti-cruelty principles in a world where we use animals in so many ways, when they're used for food and for testing and for fashion and for sport. And I think what people are doing more and more is actually logically applying this standard. And opposition to cruelty doesn't mean just not being malicious toward our pets. It means not being malicious toward any creature. And I think we're getting better, but we've got a long way to go, and that's why we need people to be involved. So I hope they go to these websites. I hope they go to Carter Blue Capital and look at investment opportunities. I hope they go to Animal Wellness Action and look at lobbying and politics. And I hope they go to the Center for a Humane Economy to influence corporations. Those are just a few of the many, many thousands of organizations that exist to advance animal welfare.
Wayne Pacelli, always great to talk to you. Keep up the good fight.
George, thanks for all you do.
We have links to those organizations on our website. I want to say thanks also to Adam Higginbotham. Great interview about his book, Midnight in Chernobyl. And appreciation to my Coast colleagues, Michael Cosio, Donna Walker, Lex Lonehood, Dan Galati, Chris Boros. I'm George Knapp. I'll be back next week. Good night, everyone.